All right. I'm Jeremy Vanderlyn. I'm representing the AIDS.gov team, and these are my teammates that have worked with me on this project. So I'm going to talk about the benefits of a mobile-first approach to public health using the AIDS.gov website as a basis for a mobile-first approach. So I wanted to take a first look at kind of the shift in our cultural identification with mobile devices. This is a picture of people actually looking at the Pope recently when he was going through D.C. And you see the wonderful, beautiful woman in the middle of the picture there, kind of absorbing it while everyone else is glancing at the Pope through the prism of their mobile device. So I love this picture for a lot of reasons, but it does kind of demonstrate, you know, this is something you wouldn't have seen 10 years ago by a significant margin. So there has been a significant cultural shift in that direction. And that kind of gets to this point, which if I was just to talk about the benefits of a mobile-first approach, is that in 2015 it's not really an option to not have some kind of mobile access to health information. It needs to work on a mobile device. That needs to be a given. If you look at the trends on Facebook, it'll show you a little bit, and just on this graph, which isn't very easy to read, you'll see that back in the third quarter of 2011, Facebook saw more mobile users than desktop users. So that's kind of that first mobile moment for Facebook, and Facebook just being kind of a general trend that we can observe in terms of how people are accessing the web overall. But then you see a second inflection point, which is this mobile-only moment, which even mobile-only users began to surpass desktop users as well. So you see kind of two inflection points there to demonstrate just how significantly people have shifted their online activity to mobile devices. So this is what AIDS.gov looks like in that context, and this is built using a technique called responsive design. Maybe you've heard of that before, but basically it allows us to build a single web page that works across a variety of devices. So I wanted to give an actual definition of mobile first, because that'll help us kind of understand the approach that we took for AIDS.gov. So understanding mobile first and foremost is, you know, the growth of mobile is a huge opportunity to reach more people than ever. In the context of public health, that's a really good thing. The constraints of the mobile media force us to focus on what really matters. So if you take a mobile first approach, you're actually you're considering a smaller screen. You are having to factor in that in addition to other things that the mobile medium will force you into. You have to consider for touch. You have to consider for the other sensors that are actually on the device. But that's actually a real advantage, because those capabilities also offer you some exciting opportunities to innovate in terms of how you actually get that content to people. So that's a working definition for mobile first. To take a look at kind of the AIDS.gov timeline in mobile adoption, what we did is we began really thinking about how we were going to do a mobile-first approach prior to 2010. Back in 2010, we launched what's called an MDOT site, which is a little different than responsive design. MDOT being basically that it redirects a segment of mobile traffic to a mobile-specific site. So it's a much kind of more pared-down version of the mobile of the website than you would see, you know, if you were to go on the desktop. So we launched that site back in August of 2010, and we were seeing about 10% of the overall traffic to AIDS.gov at that point coming from mobile devices. There was a very awesome, interesting article that came out back in May of 2010 called Responsive Web Design. I just referenced that, but it was really kind of a revolutionary way of thinking about how to convey information to mobile devices. Kind of anticipating just the proliferation of devices that are out there, whether it's tablets or all the different sizes of phones, and now you've got phablets and all of that kind of stuff. So this was kind of taking that into account and saying, when you build a web page, just take into account how big the screen size is and adjust what you do appropriately based on that screen size. So we got really excited about that at AIDS.gov and decided to go ahead and test it out. We first tested it out on a campaign site we called Facing AIDS, which allowed people to actually share photos and address the stigma around HIV/AIDS. So it was people taking photos saying, I'm facing AIDS for this reason, whether it was for a loved one, for someone they knew who was HIV positive, or for themselves. That experimentation allowed us to actually move on to really begin considering that responsive web design approach for the overall website. So another significant event that happened was that the digital government strategy was released, and obviously AIDS.gov is a federal entity. We are following this really closely, because what this mandated was that information needs to be available anywhere, anytime, and on any device. So we got excited about that because we were already working on that responsive web design launch that we launched in June of 2012. At that point, we were seeing about 25% of all of our traffic coming from mobile devices. And we saw a really significant shift over the next year, up to 2013, where we saw that inflection point, where mobile traffic actually surpassed the desktop traffic on AIDS.gov. But we really saw that responsive web design as a specific catalyst for that, given that it, not only did the traffic increase significantly, but just kind of the percentage overall of mobile users was significant. So what I'm going to do now is actually talk about kind of the principles that we applied to kind of get to that mobile-first approach for AIDS.gov specifically. So the first principle was that we actually needed to develop a hypothesis about our mobile experience that would matter to the audience that comes to AIDS.gov. And the thing that we wanted to do with that is align those project objectives to that mobile experience. So for AIDS.gov, that hypothesis is this. Users are going to share more with their personal devices. Searches and the majority of traffic that comes to AIDS.gov comes via health searches on Google. Those are emotional signals, and we need to pay attention to those emotions that people are actually bringing to that search. And then also give them information in a format that meets where they are in terms of device, context, and format, so the context that they're going to be in. We found this out early on AIDS.gov with that MDOT site that I was talking about. So when people were actually searching for information and getting to that MDOT site, they were using a whole lot more specific language to get there, and specific language in the context of sexual health. So while a desktop user would actually be searching for something like HIV statistics or HIV information, a person who was coming via their mobile device was actually going to use much more explicitly sexual language. So they would say, and I'll use the language as it was written when they searched for it, they would say, can I get HIV from a blowjob? Can I get HIV through anal sex? And so they were very specific, and they also spent more time on the website when they did that. So we really decided at that point that this was a very personal transaction that people were making, and it was a very personal search. And they were consulting their mobile devices versus using their desktop to do it. The internet is an awesome source of information, I'm sure you all know. And the other statistic that we pulled from there was that 40% of people in a health crisis are going to turn to their smartphones for health information. Needing to go and get an HIV test is a form of a health crisis. If you feel like you've put yourself or someone you care about has put themselves in a situation where they feel like they've engaged in an activity that put them at risk for HIV, that's an emotional transaction. And that kind of emotion they're going to bring to that search. And we can't ignore that. And taking a mobile-first approach actually allows us to make that transaction a little bit easier, right? If someone comes to your website and they have to pinch and zoom, or they can't find the information they're looking for, all of those things kind of are emotional signals, and you don't want people to struggle with finding the information they need to make the health decisions they're looking to make. Search can also fail, and we found this on AIDS.gov, but I'm going to use a different example first, and then I'm going to talk about our own AIDS.gov example. So this is an anecdote I heard from a guy named Jerry McGovern, but he worked with the National Health Service in the UK on this specific website. So if someone was searching for stomach pain on the National Health Service website, the first result they actually saw when they were searching was a story of a woman named Patty who had stomach pain, went into her doctor, discovered it was stomach cancer, and had her stomach removed two weeks after that initial appointment. So if you think about that in the context of discussion with your doctor, if you were to go to your doctor and say, doctor, I'm having some stomach pain, and his response to you is, well, you know what, it's probably stomach cancer, and I need to prepare you for the fact that you are going to get your stomach removed in 2 weeks. So you can kind of understand the emotional component of that kind of interaction when that's the first search result that you're giving to people when they come to the site. Is that really what people who are having stomach pain are looking to actually discover? I found this in my own personal life as well, as I have a newborn, or had a newborn in the last 2 years, and I decided to ban myself from Google Health searches after about 2 months because I was freaking myself out. So there are those kind of emotional signals. You can really, you can add a burden to people that will actually guide them away from the positive health decisions you want them to make. We had this problem on AIDS.gov too. So Specifically, people were coming looking for HIV testing. So they search, and since most people come via Google, HIV testing, they type that in, they get to the AIDS.gov website. They actually don't find the specific kind of HIV testing they're looking for, so they search for that kind of test on the site. And unfortunately, the only thing we could direct them to was actually PDFs on CDC.gov. So you can kind of see that if you're directing people to the CDC on mobile devices and giving them PDFs as the search result, that's not an optimized experience, and it's really kind of a runaround, and it's not good, and people aren't going to come back to us after that. So that was a mobile first principle number one. Mobile first principle number two is to suggest other services that are actually available that you know of, and also understanding that for mobile users, out of sight equals out of mind. We have our service locator on AIDS.gov, and what we found is that by actually giving people persistent reminders of that service locator, they're more likely to use it. So that little chiclet on the right side, or at the left side there, the service locator, people were clicking on that a whole lot more when we actually put that there and made it persistent on the page. We also found that more people were more likely to use the menu items when they actually saw them. This has been actually substantiated by Facebook, who's also done the same thing. That little, it's called a hamburger menu, is how people refer to it, but those kind of, I'm sure you've seen it on various websites. But Facebook did the same kind of study, and what they found is that more people interacted when they were presented with better and more clear choices. So that hamburger menu doesn't tell you anything, does it? But when you give people options and alerts like that tab bar underneath, you're presenting people with actual information that they can use and read and process and act upon. So out of sight, out of mind. Principle number three is to make sure you keep it brief and prioritize performance. So we had a rather long page on HIV testing on AIDS.gov. And this is actually this is a heat map with software called Crazy Egg. So you'll note that since it's a heat map, red being kind of hotter, meaning more activity, blue meaning cooler, less activity. This particular page had about 16 different sub-paragraphs. And all of it was really relevant information. If people were searching on this, they were looking for not just those first couple of paragraphs, but the majority of mobile users were actually never getting to that extra information that was towards the bottom of the page. If you think of this from the perspective of someone who actually wrote this, I'm sure they were thinking about, the fact that, the 16th paragraph was just as important as the first or the second in terms of the information about HIV that they were trying to convey. But unfortunately, mobile users were never getting there because it was just such a long page. And most of the interactions we see via mobile users, they're looking for something very specific. And like I said before, they have personal and very specific questions. So if they don't see those answers relatively soon, they're not going to stick around. It's also about prioritizing performance, and one of the other presenters actually talked a little bit about this in terms of data plans, because the more information you give people, you're actually putting a higher burden on those mobile devices and data plans, in that context as well. So you not only want to make it fast in terms of performance, you want it to load properly and load quickly and stuff like that, but you don't want to burden the user with a bunch of extra information. So that mobile-first approach means you really pare down what you're going to offer people. So keep it brief and prioritize performance. Principle number four, and this one is, kind of the dichotomy of the mobile world that we live in now, is that people are spending more time on those mobile devices, but they're also, those mobile devices are giving them lives that they actually never had in the first place. In that sense, in the context of public health, having mobile services serve as a conduit or a catalyst, but not necessarily a destination. So you don't want to necessarily keep them there. This is a really interesting photo, and I think somewhat provocative photo work by a guy named Eric Pickersgill, where he took posed pictures of people and then removed the mobile devices from their hands. So you can see kind of the stale interaction that happens when people are all looking at their mobile devices, even if they're in the presence of each other. Our director of AIDS.gov saw this picture and said this couple's really missing out on a great opportunity. And you can see here, too, that, there's just kind of, and I think even the black and white kind of illustrates this, too, that, there's just not much social interaction going on. We always want to be mindful that what we're trying to achieve has nothing to do with what people are actually doing on their phones. It's that life that they're living and that health decision that they're making outside of it. Principle number five, and this is something we really tried to accomplish because of the sensors that are there on mobile devices, is seeking to bridge the physical and digital worlds. So our testing services and care services locator is our best bet to bridge those two worlds in terms of actually giving people information that is close to them, is geolocated, and then is going to be available to them and allow them to actually go and get tested if they need to. The thing that, you know, we can't do at AIDS.gov is actually open that clinic door for people or find ways to get them in to take the actual HIV test. So we want to do everything we possibly can to get all that information to them. And this allows them to see all of that information in one place. The final thing that I think is something that we're actually working on for the future is finding trusted spaces. So even though you have all of this information that you can provide to people, it really helps. And I think even, you know, the most recent presentation on kind of the social constructs around, you know, health behaviors is about finding those trusted spaces, whether it's an interaction between a doctor and a patient or a trusted space where you can actually have that information there. A colleague of mine at the CDC was talking about something similar to this in terms of how they're trying to get a lot of their health information into the hands of doctors, into EMRs, into a lot of different ways that is going to present the same information but isn't necessarily going to be packaged as a website. So I think that's something we're thinking about for the future in terms of what mobile first can be when you look at finding those trusted spaces where people are actually interacting with each other and sharing that information together. So that's it.
I think that we got some time for some questions. To kick things off, I have a question for the panel. I think that the use of social media and online platforms is appealing to researchers and to practitioners because of the low cost, right? It's a very affordable, accessible strategy. What we heard at the beginning of our panel from Caitlin, however, was that there are some unexpected and hidden costs to perhaps the people that we're trying to reach. And I just kind of want to ask the group of, have you thought about, and maybe starting with Caitlin, about how to overcome that kind of unexpected barrier that you found, or some ways that you kind of changed your strategy as a result of that learning?
Right. Well, like I said in the presentation, the majority of people did actually have free text messages, so that's good to keep in mind. But, you know, we talked about Facebook, Instagram, all those things are totally free, so people can certainly join those, and that's an alternative. I think that I don't know like what the actual cost of one single text message would be, but I think if you were able to add kind of like that incentive in as well that I mentioned, that might offset what they might have to pay, like a few cents or something per text message. So those are two alternatives.
Anybody else on the panel want to comment on?
For the sample that I looked at in particular, internet access seems to be a barrier. You can't access social networking devices without internet access, so that was something that emerged.
I was just going to say, I saw one study specifically dealing with HIV positive men who were doing medication adherence through text messaging, where the majority of them, like if you think about text messaging and it's just a cost, the majority of them, like 94% of all of the people that were created study had some kind of unlimited message form. So the barrier wasn't there necessarily for that.
All right, how about from the group? Any questions for our panel? Please, go ahead.
But my question is, you know, since we're all moving around mobile devices, most changes are on mobile devices, does it make sense for us to use much more video, very short videos to communicate and tell us the behavior change that we're trying to go at? Because I don't know if you're looking at now a lot of video on your phone or your tablet that maybe 20 seconds or 30 seconds.
We actually found that with ours, so the first go around of the website, we did a lot of, when we first started the study, everything was like paper. So we were trying to like email attach. attachments or something, and it wasn't working, because when you get 15 attachments, people are like, yeah, no. So we tried to put them on the web, but we found that people weren't reading. It's kind of, you know, your photos that show that people read the first part, but they don't read the rest. So people weren't reading the entire program summaries, or they weren't reading all the information. So we actually switched everything over and tried to do everything in 30-second clips. So like how to enroll is like a 30-second video, and we found that people will watch the videos but they won't read the text. So we try to do both. So I think that your point really goes to that. Like our training videos are long, and they have, like, that's if you want to be as part of the intervention. But if you're doing clips to like show information, it's really important, I think, to translate it to videos, because people don't read. They'd rather just click on it and watch it. And that's why our first page now, it says like welcome. Watch a short video to learn, and it's like a 30-second video, because we found people on the home page were even reading what the program was about.
Anybody else want to address the short videos, or if that's something you're thinking about incorporating?
We've had, I think, mixed success with video, and including short videos. But a lot of what we start to do now is trying to push those videos to sharing.
So I don't know if you were here for, did you see the presentation I did?
I don't think so.
Okay, yeah, I talked about the videos in mine. We had like shortened links because it was a text message, so it had to be 160 characters. People were hesitant, like in the text, in the mHealth like text message platform, to click on them because they didn't know what it was. They didn't know how much data it was going to use, because videos really suck out the data from your data plan if you have one. And then also, we found too, is that if you're in like a school or somewhere that monitors their internet very carefully, they will block YouTube as a channel and you can't get on it. So those are just some other barriers. But I love the idea. I think that videos are really good.
Okay, other questions?
I have a question about, so all of you talked about various ways to reach people and use mHealth. So I want to ask you if you've seen any differences in the population uptake, like based on age. So certain subgroups of based on age were more receptive to certain methods of using this kind of technology.
Just in case you guys in the back didn't hear, the question is about, did the panel members see any differences by age group, kind of sub-demographics, in terms of uptake of the program? Anybody analyze that?
For our study, we didn't really have that variation because the population was the graduate students. But I really hope to expand this research to our population. So if you're interested in using this approach, we can collaborate and see whether this approach would work for our population. Even for the age was the graduate students.
I mean, our study age, like people who are younger, were more likely to use it. We also found that among adults, people who were working professionals were more likely to use mobile and iPad app, like were more likely to access the website just because they're more familiar with it. You know, those are the kind of people who always have their phone. So it was interesting to kind of see that dynamic of if that's something you're used to, that's what you use.
Any other questions? All right, well, thank you all for joining us. I encourage you all to